Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tonight could be a make-or-break moment for President Obama. He's intensifying his push for health care reform with a press conference tonight as Congress appears less likely to pass an overhaul bill before the August recess. Today, we look at a key player in this debate, the insurance industry. Insurers helped kill health care reform in the 1990s, but today they say they're on board, especially if reform means insurance for everyone, creating up to 40 million new customers who currently do not have insurance. What insurers are against is the president's idea of a public plan where the government provides health insurance to anyone who needs it. The insurers worry that could lead to a single-payer system or government-run health care. Karen Ignani is president of America's Health Insurance Plans. She's arguably Washington's most influential health industry lobbyist. And Karen, what are some of the reforms your group supports?
We've committed to, if we can get everybody in, a guarantee issue, which is a technical term that means everyone receives coverage. Two, no pre-existing condition limitations. Three, making sure that people are not paying according to their health status. And then finally, paying for value, not volume. I think the more we look on Capitol Hill and confer with members on both sides of the political aisle, there's understanding about the importance of those reforms, number one. They're pleased that we have initiated them, and in fact, they're at the building blocks in every piece of legislation moving across Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. But you do not support a public plan?
We do not.
Because?
Well, there are several reasons why. First, for physicians and hospitals, they know well that government pays for Medicaid about 65 cents on the dollar, for Medicare about 85 cents on the dollar. What happens if government doesn't pay its share of the cost of providing care? The excess gets shifted onto private payers. So that is added to the costs of any commercial plan or any employer plan, any state and local plan.
We should point out, though, that there are some people who disagree that that cost shifting is even taking place. They're saying that there's no definite proof that those costs, those lower reimbursement rates on the part of Medicare and Medicaid, are then being shifted onto the backs of private insurers.
I think that's a very important point you've just made. I would just point those individuals to the state of California, where we can see each hospital by payer what amount has been shifted.
Let's go back to something you mentioned earlier, and that was the issue of pre-existing medical conditions or denying coverage to sick people. Is the no pre-existing condition contingent upon not having a public plan?
No. We need insurance market reform. We're for it. So that needs to happen, notwithstanding anything else. The issue of whether there should be a government-run program is a separate question, and we're concerned about that, as I indicated, because it is going to be a very unlevel playing field and an inability to compete, which means that every employer will have a strong incentive to go to the government plan, and in very short order, there won't be a private sector that can be sustained. So given the economics of all of this, it really gets you very quickly to a single-payer system. Now, indeed, that's what some individuals want. If that's what the country wants to discuss, we ought to discuss that straight up.
Well, you know, we should say, though, President Obama has said that he does not want a government-run health care system, and he's also said, why are insurers afraid of this public option? He says, why couldn't private insurers compete with better service so people would then be more attracted to go to the private option anyway?
Well, we are paying on average now across the country for hospital services. This is an average 132% of costs. Medicare pays at about 85 to 88, depending upon the state. You don't have to be an economist to understand the disequilibrium that that creates in a system. So, yes, we can provide service. Yes, we can provide disease management and care coordination and incent quality performance, all the things that we've brought to the delivery system working with physicians and hospitals. But the fact is, given that economic disequilibrium, there's no level playing field.
A lot of folks, though, look at, and the president has mentioned this as well, the profits made by the healthcare industry. And he says, you know, if we look at the astronomical profits made by some health insurers, and why should that be allowed when the government can run this program in maybe in a different way, but similarly to Medicare.
I think that this has become a bit of a red herring. The data that have been pointed to talk about the profits of the top 10 health plans in the country. That is approximately $13 billion right now. We are spending $2.5 trillion.
But $13 billion is still quite a profit.
$13 billion compared to the pharmaceutical companies now are at 57. Hospitals are much higher because, of course, there are so many more of them. We can go right down the line to so many other entities in the healthcare system. If we're going to have a debate about going to single payer where there's no commercial enterprise, then I think that's a different debate than the healthcare reform debate.
Why should it be that health insurance should be essentially more of a private matter or even an employer-funded program instead of the government taking an active role in this because of the agreed-to need for reform?
I do think this country is different than other countries. We've had a tradition of public activity through Medicaid and Medicare, and private sector through employers and individuals purchasing on their own. And people talk about creating a uniquely American structure, and I think taking the best of both sides. That's the gold standard here. Our view is that we ought to have strong, clear, uniform regulation and more accountability for the American people, more consumer protection. And we are for that. But I think we've reached a fork in the road. Entities, stakeholders in the healthcare community are expected to enter the policy discussion with how do you fix the problem, as opposed to saying no or standing by or refusing to roll up your sleeves and lending a hand.
Karen Ignani, president of America's Health Insurance Plans, or AHIP. She's been talking with us about her ideas for healthcare reform. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
For patients with prostate cancer, a common surgical procedure that's often done is brachytherapy or seed therapy. It involves implanting irradiated seeds in the prostate so the radiation attacks cancer cells. But for more than 6 years, almost all the brachytherapy performed at the Veterans Hospital in Philadelphia was botched. Mostly by one doctor who's now under scrutiny following an investigative report by the New York Times last month. The Philadelphia Brachytherapy Program and two other VA programs like it were shut down last year when regulators began asking questions. In its reporting, the New York Times pieced together the story of Dr. Gary Kaoh, whom the paper described as working at a rogue cancer unit which operated with little outside scrutiny and kept quiet about the bad surgeries. Dr. Kaoh denied those allegations at congressional hearings in Philadelphia last month. He testifies at another hearing in Washington today. Walt Bogdanich is the Pulitzer Prize-winning assistant editor for investigations at the New York Times. He reported and wrote this story. We'll also be joined by Ricardo Flippin, an Air Force veteran who's now a preacher and a former patient of Dr. Kaoh's. But Walt, let's start with you. Tell us what you found.
Well, what I found was quite a remarkable situation where a medical team within the VA in Philadelphia had managed to mess up 92 of 116 procedures. I've been covering healthcare for 3 decades, and I must say I've never quite seen anything like this. Those mistakes were spread not over a week or 6 months or even a year, but more than 6 years. Mistakes continued to happen, and nobody stepped up to complain or to voice concerns or to do anything about it.
And what type of mistakes are we talking about?
One of the first cases that I wrote about was an incident where the radiation oncologist had inserted more than half of the seeds outside the prostate. And that is an unusual event. It should be obvious to anyone that that's not the way it's supposed to work.
And most of these surgeries were also done by one doctor, Dr. Kaoh, who no longer treats patients. But at the time, he had been a doctor in good standing.
He was, and with the exception of these treatments, continues to be. So it really does raise the question, why here and why for so long? And why could someone of his standing and education, I mean, he has a PhD, a medical degree, you know, was educated at an Ivy League medical institution, how could someone with those kinds of credentials make mistakes time and time and time again.
So let's talk about that. When there is a mistake in a case like this, especially when radiation is involved, is there a formal procedure by which mistakes are supposed to be reported to a particular agency? And are you saying that that wasn't done? And was Dr. Kao supposed to be doing something that wasn't done properly?
Well, when mistakes happen, according to federal rules, they must be reported to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. In this case, 90 of those procedures were not reported according to federal rules. And when those procedures were not reported, investigations were not conducted.
I've read some of what Dr. Kao has said in his testimony about this, and he said, you know, he led a team of people who were supposed to be all contributing to this type of surgery.
Mistakes are almost never the result of one person. The blame is shared by many, many different people, many different agencies. It was not just Dr. Kao's fault. It was the fault of the VA for not properly monitoring the administration of radioactive treatments. It was the fault of the people working within that unit. And I think one of the more disturbing aspects of this story, according to the federal investigators, is that some of the people in that team did realize that the procedures were coming up short and apparently did not protest or take action.
Reverend Flippin, I'd like to ask you, you had this operation done. What happened after that? Can you tell us?
Well, basically, I don't know how many of the seeds were misplaced in my rectum, but I ended up with an ulcer in my rectum, which literally meant that the radiation seeds were actually burning the tissue in my rectum, which caused me to experience extreme pain. And I basically was bedridden for about 4.5 to 5 months. Right, I lost my job as a result of it. I was working for a nonprofit organization with no benefits. I couldn't even go to work, so I literally resigned.
Did you realize that the health problems you were having were connected to the surgery?
No, I didn't, because I had so much confidence in the doctor who met with me in Philadelphia and described the procedure to me. And he said that he had performed over 600 of the procedures himself.
The doctor that Reverend Flippin is referring to, who said he did 600 procedures, turned out not to be the doctor who did his procedure. That doctor turned out to be Dr. Gary Kao, who did, in fact, far fewer procedures in his work than the doctor who had consulted with Reverend Flippin.
And then Reverend Flippin, so I'm wondering, when exactly did you realize that the health problems that you were having were, in fact, because of this surgery?
When I was referred to Ohio State University Hospital, and Dr. Arnold examined me, and he said, "You have he said, "You're suffering from a radiation burn." That was 2 years later.
That's Reverend Ricardo Flippin. He's suing over a botched surgery performed at the Veterans Hospital in Philadelphia in 2005. The VA notified him and other veterans about the substandard care they'd received by letter last summer. Right now, Reverend Flippin is a project coordinator for CareNet, Caring Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, where he helps vets navigate the VA health system. We'll be back with him and Walt Bogdanich of the New York Times in just a moment. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the New York Times investigation of botched prostate cancer surgeries at the Philadelphia Veterans Hospital. The paper found there were significant mistakes in about 90% of the brachytherapy on prostate cancer patients there between 2002 and 2008. Most of the surgeries were done by one doctor, Gary Kao, who has adamantly denied wrongdoing. We're speaking with Walt Bogdanich, the New York Times reporter who put together this story, and Reverend Ricardo Flippin, who is suing over his 2005 surgery where irradiated seeds were mistakenly planted into his rectum. Reverend, how's your health now?
Great, except for the side effects that I experience. Loss of bowel control movements. And one of the things I'm really conscious of is that I work with the public doing what I do at church. And consequently, there are times when I have to get up and leave and come back. And maybe if it's a three-hour arrangement, I might get up two or three times during that time. And that's embarrassing, you know.
Can you work again? I mean, is
it? Yes, I am. Yes, mm-hmm. I can.
So you can work again, and you've pretty much gotten your health back.
Yes, yes.
Because what had happened had to be medically corrected?
Yes.
Walt, when folks hear Reverend Flippin's story, I'm sure that they must be wondering, is this sort of common at the VA, or is this unusual? Was it just this one unit?
Well, to this extent, yes, it is very unusual. It is not unusual for mistakes to happen in brachytherapy. I'm aware of mistakes happening in many places outside the VA. One of the problems that I have found in trying to quantify the problem, quite honestly, is that many of these are not always reported. So coming up with an accurate number of how often mistakes happen is not possible right now.
Reverend, I'm wondering, you're someone who actually helps people navigate the VA system, and at that hearing in Philadelphia where Dr. Kao defended himself adamantly against some of these charges, you actually hugged him. How are you feeling about him now?
After he had given his testimony and I expressed that I was disappointed that Dr. Kao, in his remarks, never looked at me or even expressed a contrition that, such as, you know, "I'm sorry it happened, Reverend Flippin." And so it was my movement that got me to stand up and go over and, you know, kind of express that, you know, I have compassion for you. And to know what has happened, that they knew it, and even when they informed me of it, they did not inform me of it in a manner that I would say that foretold all of what we're finding out. It's like we made a little mistake and we just want to check with you and find out if you're all right. That's the way it came across.
If I may,
yes.
Since Dr. Kao is not here, what he was saying in so many words was that, hey, what I did is not unusual. And this is as much an art as it is a science in the placement of these seeds. And to a certain extent, he's right, but in a very small extent, because good radiation oncologists put the seeds where they're supposed to go. He's claiming that, well, this goes on frequently, and frankly, he didn't, as far as I could tell, back that up with any kind of evidence.
I wonder, he says overstating, and I almost wonder, calling this a rogue cancer unit and using words like that, when did you decide that it was worthy of that type of description? And is it, you know, almost crossing the line into overstating?
Well, it's certainly not crossing the line into overstating, or we wouldn't have said it. My comments were really based on the substance of this investigative report. Think about it for a minute. For more than 6 years, they continued to make mistake after mistake after mistake, and in some cases knew that mistakes were made, knew that inadequate amounts of radiation were being delivered, knew that the actual implantation of the seeds did not match the surgical plan, and yet never took any action to report it. And in fact, continued on their merry way year after year after year.
I'm wondering, and I'd like to ask both of you this question, Walt and Reverend Flippin, what advice do you give folks now in terms of when they're about to undergo procedures at a VA system?
Well, it's not only a good idea when you're in the VA system to ask all the appropriate questions, but it's a good idea when you're in any hospital before you undergo some kind of surgical procedure. You should ask who's doing it. You should look into the qualifications of the doctor. You should look into their work experience. How often have they done these procedures?
And Reverend Flippin?
I would agree with Walt 100%, except I would add not to be intimidated because this person has MD behind their name. Also, not to be rushed because you're thinking about all the other veterans that are sitting out in the hallway waiting to see the doctor. Also, remember, this is your life, and no one cares more about it than you.
Mm-hmm. I hope that things get better for you. I hope your health continues to improve, Reverend.
Now, thank you very much.
Reverend Ricardo Flippin is suing over a botched brachytherapy performed at the Veterans Hospital in Philadelphia in 2005. Walt Bogdanich is the Pulitzer Prize-winning assistant editor for investigations at the New York Times, who uncovered this story of the doctor who performed the surgeries at the VA in Philadelphia. Walt, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a provocative conversation about reforming higher education. One idea is to reduce the amount of time it takes for a bachelor's degree from 4 to 3 years to make college cheaper.
I like to talk about higher ed as a kind of petrified forest frozen in time. This would force the unfreezing.
That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, a report from Myanmar, also known as Burma, where democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is still on trial. Back after the news, Here and Now. President Obama welcomes Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to the White House today. While Afghanistan seems to get most of the recent attention, Iraq is still a dangerous place for civilians and soldiers. Last week, in a quiet area in southern Iraq, a mortar attack killed 3 soldiers from the Minnesota National Guard, all members of the Red Bull Infantry. An Iraqi insurgent trained in Iran has been charged and has confessed, saying he and his accomplices were trying to destabilize the country. Killed in the attack were 22-year-old Dan Drevnik, 27-year-old Carlos Wilcox, and 20-year-old James Wardish. Joining us on the line from Olivia, Minnesota, is James Wardish's father, David. And David, we're very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about James?
Oh, he grew up on the farm here with his mother, Kim, and I, and 2 sisters and a younger brother. He graduated from the local high school, Bold High School, in 2007. 2006, his junior year, he joined the National Guard on his own behalf. That was his wishes, even with knowing they told him straight up that he'd probably be deployed, and he said he was fine with that. He took his AIT training for military police at Fort Leonard Wood right after he graduated, and he was assigned to the Stillwater MP group from Stillwater, Minnesota, part of the 34th Red Bull. They were deployed on mid-April. They left the States and went to Kuwait. We did talk to him the Saturday before he died. Had a very nice conversation with him, and he was telling us about his future plans, which was really nice.
What did he say? What were his future plans?
Well, he wanted to become a police officer, and that was his goal. Him and, we found out afterwards, Dan Drevnik wanted to both become, you know, officers. That was his ultimate goal.
He must have been very passionate about the military if he went and enlisted on his own when he was a junior in high school.
Yes, he was a little bit, how do I say it, on the wild side and when he was in high school. And all of a sudden, one day, he came home and said, I want to sign up for the Guard. And I told my wife, I said, this is okay with me. We had discussed it with him and talked about the deployment and some of the, you know, things that could happen. And he was okay with that. And as long as he was okay with that, he had a good head on his shoulders. And we figured that's fine with us.
So he was very fun-loving.
Yes, very fun-loving. That's a nice way to put it. He was pretty quiet with his mother and I, but around his friends, he was very fun-loving. He had a lot of friends, a lot of good friends.
Your daughter, Carolyn's also in the National Guard. Has she been deployed?
She is an Air Force officer. She had gone to college in the Air Force ROTC program, and she joined the Air Force. She will be going for her training in August.
Does what happened to James change the way you feel about your daughter's participation in the military?
No. No. I have full confidence in the military. I have the utmost respect for everybody in it. We are not a military family. James was the first one, or Carolyn actually, joined at the ROTC level about the same time James joined the Guard. I have no reservations. If I had another child that wanted to go in, I would not deter them.
There has been an arrest, and apparently a man confessed to being responsible for the mortar attack. Does that give you any peace of mind?
At first, I didn't think much about it, you know, and after a while, I thought, well, that's wonderful. You know, it brings a little more closure to things, but it's, you know, it might open a whole new can of worms here for us if they do find that another country is involved and more people are involved. I hope we can get to the bottom of it. I pray for the peace for their people and for ours. I'm not a vindictive man. It's hard not to be, but I have some concerns that, you know, I don't want it to happen again.
David Wordish, speaking with us from Olivia, Minnesota. He's the father of James Wordish, who was killed in Iraq last Thursday. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. All I ask is that all Americans keep these boys in Afghanistan and throughout the world and Iraq in their prayers.
Back in a moment, here and now. Speaking in Thailand today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sharply criticized the military rulers of Myanmar for alleged human rights abuses. She also said a policy review on Myanmar, which is also known as Burma, is on hold pending the outcome of the trial of democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Suu Kyi is accused of violating the terms of her house arrest when an American swam to her lakeside home in May. Critics of the military government believe the incident was just an excuse to extend the Nobel Peace Prize winner's detention. She has now spent 14 of the last 20 years in some form of government custody. For the Burmese people, Suu Kyi represents hope that one day there will be an end to the military repression there. We have this report from a BBC correspondent who traveled to the country. Journalists are not allowed to work freely in Burma, so for his safety and the safety of those he spoke with, he is not being identified.
The morning ferry in Rangoon crosses the river that leads to the Irrawaddy Delta, where tens of thousands of people were killed in last year's cyclone. Crammed onto the decks, those who can afford newspapers can read about events on the other side of the world. Disputed elections in Iran may be in black and white, but there is nothing about Aung San Suu Kyi, whose trial started in May. Many believe that this trial is far too convenient a way for the generals to stop her taking part in next year's election. I had come to Burma to find out what will happen if, as many expect, she is found guilty, and why this woman, who is called the Lady, is feared by the generals who command an army of 400,000. On the streets of Rangoon, the answer has to be whispered. Informers are everywhere. Everyone is afraid. But Aung San Suu Kyi remains a symbol of the hopes of those opposed to the generals who rule this country. And I found that both old and new technology are being used to keep her in people's minds. In a cafe, I was told to turn on my phone. Moments later, an image of the opposition leader appeared on the screen. If I was caught with this picture, I would be arrested. To openly speak to anyone, you have to be taken to somewhere where you cannot be seen or listened to. So I travelled out of Rangoon. The opposition supporter I met had lived through the British and Japanese occupation of his country. He told me that outside help is needed.
I can say definitely. Maybe English or American, only two countries can help us. Other countries cannot help us.
If Aung San Suu Kyi is put into prison and people start to protest, would you go out and join those protests?
If we can, I like to join them. I like to join with them, yes.
Do you think that the army would shoot the protesters?
Their mind is always to kill the people. They don't want to give their power to the civilian government.
I left Rangoon for Burma's second city, Mandalay, where 60% of the country's monks once lived. Now many have left. Early in the morning, I visited a monastery to watch the monks and novices have breakfast. Hundreds of saffron-robed men and boys queued for their food. 2 years ago, I would not have been able to enter here. Soldiers surrounded this monastery to stop monks joining the marches. They are suspicious of strangers and afraid of speaking of the past. Just as I was leaving, one beckoned to me.
I hate it. I'm very hate the our government.
You do?
Yeah.
Why?
I'm frightened our government. I'm frightened Kimbra.
Just saying this could lead to jail. Amnesty International say over 2,000 people are still incarcerated after the protests of 2007. I had heard that behind closed doors, people were handing out pictures of the pro-democracy leader. To many, just having her image gives them hope. So I travelled to the 200-year-old Oon Bain Bridge on the outskirts of the city to meet an opposition supporter. Below me, fishermen cast their nets into the lake it spans. People pushed their bicycles across the footbridge, and monks in saffron robes passed by. Only here, on the world's longest teak bridge, did he feel he could speak to me. The man I met was a newspaper editor, whose publication was closed by the government for writing about the opposition. His voice is disguised for his own safety.
Hello. Thank you very much for being brave enough to meet me.
He slowly took from his breast pocket a colour photograph of Aung San Suu Kyi, which he was given that morning, an image which gives him hope.
Why is his trial and his verdict so important?
Because people love Aung San Suu Kyi, people believe Aung San Suu Kyi. She's our hope.
As I left this picturesque place, I heard that the night before, leaflets had been distributed to the houses in the dead of night, alleging that the American, who many believe had conveniently caused her arrest, was actually her lover. This was a smear campaign, Burmese style. I returned to Rangoon to meet an opposition leader, a man in hiding from the police. I waited to hear where to go, at the Shwedagon Pyre, a place of peace and contemplation, the most sacred of all Buddhist sites in Burma. At a secret location, we met one of the leaders of the National League of Democracy, someone the army wished to silence. He told me that everyone is scared because they know that if they demonstrate, the army will shoot them. So all he can do is call for a hunger strike outside the prison, and those who do will be arrested. It's monsoon season here. Here, many cannot afford to eat, and the government do not seem to care, so a hunger strike will not bring change. For the people who have watched the opposition crushed in Tehran, know that the outcome of next year's elections mean nothing if those in power do not want to let go. But the generals are scared of Aung San Suu Kyi. She is the symbol of what was and what may be.
That report from the BBC. Because journalists are not allowed to work freely in Burma and for the safety of those who spoke with him, the BBC correspondent is not being identified. Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, hereandnow.org. For past programs, click on the archives, and you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's hereandnow.org. And before we go today, Kate Walbert's A Short History of Women. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. The title of Kate Walbert's new book, A Short History of Women, makes it sound as if it might be nonfiction, maybe a memoir, but it's a fascinating novel about five generations of women spanning from Victoria-era England to modern-day New York City. The women's stories have similar themes: struggles with love and motherhood, the role of women in society, how men and women are different, big themes for, yes, a short book. It does all of this in less than 250 pages. The novel begins in the early 1900s with the story of Dorothy, a woman who is literally dying for suffrage, the right to vote.
Mum starved herself for suffrage, grandmother claiming it was just like Mum to take a cause too far. Mum said she had no choice. Besides, she said, starving made the world brighter, took away the dull edges, the disappointment. She said this in hospital, the place not entirely unpleasant, a private room, windows ammonia-washed, looking out to a tree branch on windless days, an ivy-covered wall.
A Short History of Women has received rave reviews. The New York Times called it a gorgeously wrought and ultimately wrenching work of art. And author Kate Walbert joins us from the Argo Network Studios in New York. Kate, welcome.
Thank you.
Several of these stories in this book have been published before, but I'm wondering, was an overview of the themes of these women's lives with you before you wrote the book, or did you start writing the stories and then realize that you could thread them all together like this?
I really started with the voice of Evelyn, who's the daughter of the original Dorothy, the woman who starves herself for suffrage. It was her voice that drew me into the world of Victorian England, late Victorian England, specifically with the line, Mum starved herself for suffrage, grandmother claiming it was just like Mum to take a cause too far. I actually wrote that line many years ago and in a sense, circled around it for a long time. I wrote Evelyn's story, some of Evelyn's story. I wrote her mother's story a bit, but wasn't sure where I was going with any of it. So no, there was never any kind of overarching plan or outline. It was more writing from that voice, and then later on, wanting to escape it in some ways, I wrote some of the later stories and realized with the characters in those later stories that there was a kind of a continuity of the interior lives of these women. And once I realized that, it opened up the novel for me because, in a sense, it gave me permission to go all the way from the late 1800s to 2007. Because I felt as if there was something linking all of these women. And so the novel was very much constructed that way.
Hmm. And explain what you think links all of these women primarily. Is it, in a way almost, the fact that a mother will always shape the woman a daughter becomes?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, it's not, and honestly, it's not something that I thought about while I was working on the book. It was more that there was just this impulse and a feeling that the women were connected, and I gave them the same family. Obviously, one thing that links them is that they're all part of the same family. But it was only after finishing the book and being able to really look back and think, well, what have I written here, which is how books work for me, that I could see that the link kind of went beyond family and was really about how your grandmother's life affected your mother's life, how did that then affect yours, and how is it in turn affecting your children? You know, in some ways, it's this notion that, yes, time passes and that there is this chronology of time, and yet also you have a kind of an emotional life that almost remains constant and keeps circling back and circling back. And I think that each woman of the ensuing generations, each daughter, inherited that from her mother.
And yet, even though there may have been, you know, these inherited themes passed down from generation to generation, it also seems that the women never spoke directly with their mothers. And as a matter of fact, that's highlighted at the very end where the mother and daughter are communicating with each other and the daughter has assumed an anonymous name online to do so.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I've actually never thought about that before. But, you know, I've always been as interested in a way in the silences of every story. For instance, you know, if somebody is telling a story and there's, you hear a very pregnant pause or there's a gap or there's the use of a word that signals it's not quite what they're saying it is. As a writer, those are the places that I go to, you know, to try to ferret it out. You know, you might hear somebody say, well, you know, she divorced her husband after 50 years, and then there's a pause. He was a very nice man. And it was more in the pause, not in what you're actually given, that you hear the whole history of that relationship somehow. So I guess given this question, I've actually put the silences into the book. So they're not speaking directly necessarily to one another, or what they're saying when they speak to one another doesn't address specifically what's going on between the two of them.
Right, right. In the love question, all of the women seem obviously are like all people, right? They want love in their lives, but it's something that's very difficult for them, and their search for love ultimately is unsatisfying in a lot of ways. Why is that?
I think that perhaps it's more that the women are constantly thinking about how to reinvent their lives. They're thinking about how can they put on another skin, how can they do it over, and fixing what you didn't do right the first time. So the granddaughter of the suffragette, who's also named Dorothy, she has, for me, a very tender relationship with her husband, Charles. In the end, though, decides to leave him, in effect, to reinvent her life, at the end of her life, to reinvent her life, and yet feels very fondly toward him. So it's complicated how they approach it. It's complicated how they approach marriage. And yet I think it's also a way of them breaking all ties in order to get to that place where they can reinvent.
Mm-hmm. Do you think because so much of this is focused on self-expression and women inventing the life that they want to have for themselves or reinventing it, depending on what the situation is, do you mm-hmm. think that that's still a very difficult thing for women?
I think that it's just a difficult thing. I guess I would say I think that's always a challenge for anyone. And I found myself focusing on generations of women. I kind of grew up listening more to women than to men, in a way. So I think that's where I go.
And then, of course, we have the question of how women are viewed by society through all of this. In one of the stories, there was actually a talk titled A Short History of Women, the title of your book, and it was right. in 1914, and it was on the woman question, you know, the difference between men and women. And it seems like a question that we're still asking today. Not all that long ago, many of us, certainly here in Massachusetts, remember the controversy over former Harvard President Lawrence Summers suggesting that perhaps there were innate differences between men and women, which was the reason why there weren't women at the top of their professions in math and science. So it seems like the woman question really is still a question that's being asked.
It comes around. And in fact, that happened right around the time I was working on that chapter. And as I remember from reading the talk, there was a line, now I might misquote it, but the line was different availability of aptitude at the high end, which I actually promptly put in my book in that lecture, to tell you the truth.
Kate Walbert's book is titled A Short History of Women. Kate, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.